It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Well, a ton to cover, so let's just dive right in.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And we're going to kind of reverse the order. We're going to start with international this week, since that has been so prominent.
Yeah, and I'm actually heading out of town the next 3 weeks, hopefully. If we can figure out how to make it work, I'll be doing this over the phone from various parts of the U.S., and hopefully we won't be in World War III by then. But the situation in the Middle East right now is really, really dangerous. And it's not just a question of Israel invading Lebanon after the attack by Hezbollah on Wednesday. And, you know, I have to say the media coverage in this country of what has been going on with Gaza and Hamas, Israel, and now with Hezbollah and Lebanon, and the potential involvement of Syria and Iran has been horrible. It really has. The situation in the south and the situation in the north are not unrelated, obviously, but they are not identical. It's not simply a matter of terrorists in the south, terrorists in the north. Hamas and Hezbollah are very different organizations, different histories. One's Sunni, one's Shiite. They don't particularly cooperate with one another in a lot of ways. You know, there's different histories, et cetera. You know, different goals of the two organizations. And, you know, the context of the kidnapping of Israeli soldiers by Palestinians a couple of weeks ago, which is what has touched off this latest escalation, was a direct response to 2 weeks of Israeli you know, shelling of Gaza and 6 months of Gaza being under siege, which hadn't been widely reported. And we talked on this show about the humanitarian crisis, which is still deepening in Gaza. There's still a lot going on there. Hezbollah was pretty much an unprovoked attack. You know, what Hezbollah is saying is that it was done in solidarity with what the Palestinians in Gaza are going through. But there's other agendas going on there also. Hezbollah has its own agenda in terms of the plans of the Lebanese government to try and disarm it. Iranian missiles were used in the attack on Haifa a couple of days ago, and so Iran and probably also Syria are implicated in this. And the real danger right now is that Israel will launch a direct strike on either Syria or, more likely, Iran. And if either of those happens, one is the same as the other, because Syria and Iran signed a mutual defense pact earlier this year saying that if one is attacked, the other will come to its defense. Iran was saying just a day ago that if there is an attack on Syria, there will be a swift and severe retaliation by Iran. And of course, if Israel attacks, the assumption in Tehran, the assumption in the entire Muslim world, if not the entire rest of the world, is that the United States will be complicit in that, because Israel would not do something that is such an escalation. In fact, they probably didn't even launch the attack on Lebanon without at minimum a green light from Washington. In the case of an attack on Iran, it would more likely be with the active military cooperation of Washington. And so, you know, the United States has soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq and, you know, ships in the Persian Gulf and oil that this country relies on, the global economy relies on, in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. And, you know, all of those are open to retribution by Iran. And, you know, the whole thing could very, very easily and plausibly in the next few days result in the United States being at war with Iran. And you know, and from there it can spread. It's an incredibly dangerous situation. And you have to ask yourself in all this, what is George Bush doing? Right now he's at the G8 in Russia. He got there a day early to talk with Vladimir Putin, and hopefully, they haven't really said a whole lot publicly, but hopefully, you know, Putin is one of the few people who has a decent amount of leverage over the Iranian mullahs due to their fairly close financial ties and the Russians being willing to negotiate with them over the whole uranium enrichment question. Russia cut a pipeline deal with Iran that was not widely reported in the U.S. a couple weeks ago to build a pipeline that would service India and Pakistan and the western parts of Asia, cutting the dependence of much of Asia on the United States for some of those things. So, you know, there's all that tension there. China, of course, has oil deals with Iran as well. So they're also involved in all this. It's an incredibly messy situation. Hopefully, Putin can get the Iranian mullahs to back down. Bush can get the leaders of Israel to back down. But, you know, if you take Bush's history, and so far he's spent 5 years allowing Israel to do pretty much whatever it wants to with the Palestinians, and if you take the public statements of Bush and of White House officials and John Bolton at the UN, you know, the U.S. is really the only international player out there that is defending Israel in all this. The U.N. Security Council, before all this started happening on Wednesday, the United States had actually vetoed a Security Council resolution condemning Israel for what it was doing to the Palestinians in Gaza. You know, what it is doing in Gaza and what it is now doing to the Lebanese, who are very much caught in the crossfire of all this, you know, they're war crimes. They're collective punishment of civilians that are caught in the middle. It's bombing and destruction of civilian infrastructure, and, you know, and an awful lot of civilian deaths, you know, in order to, for, you know, Israel certainly has a right to defend itself, and it's given at this point that IDF ground forces will move back into southern Lebanon. They haven't been there in 6 years. At the same time, the Israeli actions have also pretty much cut the Lebanese government off at the knees. This is the same Lebanese government that was supposedly the triumph of Bush's policy of pushing democracy in the Middle East just last year. They're probably the government of Lebanon that's the first one in decades that would have any degree of sympathy to the concerns of the Israeli government, but Israel didn't even give them a chance or give them the assets to try and rein in Hezbollah themselves. They just declared war on Lebanon and blockaded it and started bombing the heck out of it. Very, very dangerous situation. And, you know, for people who are concerned about the involvement of this country in a major regional conflagration, you know, we need to make our voices heard. People on Capitol Hill need to make their voices heard. You know, Bush cannot stand by and simply watch Israel involve the United States in a major war to the extent that we're not already involved. He has to be an active leader on this, and there's a question of whether he wants to do that. If he does, whether he has the diplomatic chops to do it, and even if he does that, whether it would be successful or whether the Israelis would go ahead and do what they feel they need to do. So it's a very, very treacherous situation.
All right. Moving along, that is actually, for the first time in a long time, taken Iraq off the front page for a while.
Yeah, and it's in a week when Iraq really shouldn't have been off the front page. An awful lot is happening in Iraq right now as well. Baghdad has just gone to Hades in a handbasket in the last week. I mean, it was already very, very bad, but the first 4 days of this week, over 160 people, at least, that are known, were killed in sectarian violence. West Baghdad is in an open state of civil war at this point between Sunni and Shiite militias. You know, gun battles raging everywhere. The exodus of people from Iraq by any means possible, and particularly from Baghdad, is just incredible. You know, buses, planes, by foot, any way that people can get out of Iraq right now, they're trying to get out. It is an absolute disaster in the making. We're finally seeing the low-grade civil war that's been going on, you know, really for nearly a year now, between Shiites and Sunnis, just spin completely out of control. And this, of course, you know, after Zarqawi was killed and after we had our supposed national unity government in Iraq. In fact, in the in the time since that national unity government that was supposed to guarantee peace in Iraq was formed 6 weeks ago, we've had at least 1,600 deaths of civilians in the Baghdad area. That people know of. Meanwhile, we have General Casey saying that, well, this is all the fault of Al-Qaeda and, you know, and Shiites that are are launching revenge attacks in response to Al-Qaeda. So Al-Qaeda is prompting all this. It's just absolutely clueless. You know, the United States military is not that stupid. They have to know what's going on. So, I mean, what Casey is doing and what the White House is doing is a more extreme version of what they've been doing for the last 3 years, which is lying to the American public about what's going on in Iraq. And, you know, it's not a time for trying to sugarcoat what's happening there. You know, the United States has very few options at this point, but, you know, the Iraqi government is helpless at this point to prevent it. Their security forces and police forces have never been more than extensions of the sectarian militias that have heavily infiltrated them and used their uniforms and used their weapons to carry out their own agendas. And the American forces are basically standing by and not getting involved. You know, we've been hearing the argument for years that, well, the American troops can't leave because if they leave, there'll be civil war. Well, now we have the civil war, and the American troops have done nothing to prevent it. In fact, the destruction that they've brought has played a large part in helping to bring this on. So it's a very bad situation in Iraq right now as well. And of course, if Iran gets involved in any kind of a regional conflict, their ability to turn around and launch attacks within Iraq just makes the whole situation even worse. So it's just not good. And, you know, again, all of this comes back to George Bush. It comes back to his decision to invade Iraq. It comes back to his decision in the war on terror to prioritize invading Iraq over trying to deal with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and instead abandoning even the semi-ludicrous roadmap to peace and just giving first Sharon and now Omar a free hand to do whatever they want with the Palestinians. And it comes from the very confrontational policy that the United States has pursued vis-a-vis Iran, you know, refusing to negotiate, trying to isolate it diplomatically. Instead, what the Iranians and are seemingly attempting to do right now is isolate Israel and the United States diplomatically. Every country at the G8, you know, all of these being allies of the United States, has condemned Israel's disproportionate use of force in Lebanon this week, except the United States. They're trying to come out with a joint communique out of the G8, and it's basically the U.S. against everybody else in terms of deciding what to say. The U.S. is really isolated in its approach on this because, number one, Israel is violating all norms of international law and the Geneva Conventions and the rules of engagement in war, with what it is doing in targeting civilians and defending itself against Hezbollah. And, you know, beyond that, the United States has created a situation in Iraq that is just an absolute nightmare. And, you know, there are no easy solutions at this point.
All right, moving along, there was the bombings in India this week.
Yes, and the media coverage of that was very interesting. Of course, this was a day or two before everything blew up in the Middle East, so to speak. But it was very interesting in that the terrorist acts in India as a result of the conflict in Kashmir have been going on for decades. Most notoriously in 2001, when the same group that's now being blamed for the bombings in Mumbai this week stormed the Indian Parliament in New Delhi. There was a major bombing in 1993 in Mumbai that killed 200 some people at the stock exchange there. This one wasn't quite as big, but it was the first major attack in Mumbai in the 13 years since. You know, in 1993 when that happened, the story was, I didn't go back in the microfiche and check, but my guess is that attack was probably, you know, buried on page A13 somewhere, you know, under the headline, "People in the far corner of the world die." And, you know, this week it was front page news because we're so sensitive to the idea of terrorism and particularly Islamic terrorism. But this is very specific to the Indian-Pakistani conflict. But once again, the United States cut a deal with India this year, taking what were its unauthorized nuclear tests from last decade, which at the time we launched economic sanctions against both India and Pakistan for becoming nuclear powers. And we basically guaranteed India more access to nuclear weapons with that deal. So once again, the Muslim world is going to see this as the United States ganging up against the Muslims and taking sides in that conflict. So this also involves the United States. And of course, since 1993, the U.S. is much more closely tied with India in terms of its economy. You know, if you have a service call right now, you're talking to somebody in Mumbai or you know, Hyderabad or one of those cities. In fact, we talked to somebody from Mumbai last night while we were trying to get our computer help. Again, it's just a situation where the United States has become and its allies have become targets all over the world. It really is going to have to come to a point, hopefully fairly soon, where we're starting to make some fairly fundamental questioning of the priorities of the United States foreign policy and how we prosecute the so-called war on terror.
Yeah, it's unfortunate we really don't have enough time to go into it, but within a week of each other of the North Korean missile tests, there was missile tests in India, and of course North Korean ones receiving a lot of coverage in the press, and the India test pretty much was almost silent,
yes,
except for a single article.
That's absolutely right.
All right. Let's move along to the elections in Mexico.
Yeah, and that also is not a done deal, even though the Electoral Oversight Board in Mexico that declares winners declared the conservative candidate Calderon a winner on Thursday. But that is contested. There still has to be another 7-judge panel that has the authority to order a full recount of all the ballots, which is what the other candidate, the leftist candidate Lopez Obrador, is asking for. There will be a large rally in Mexico City tomorrow from his supporters, and there's just widespread belief, and we're going to have an article in next week's Eat the State from Troy Skills, our former editor who lives in Oaxaca these days, where there's widespread belief among Mexicans that fraud was committed. There's a lot of evidence to support it, and of course there's a long history of it in Mexico, and there's also a lot of evidence that the Bush administration actively intervened on behalf of the conservative candidate in this close an election that was one of the margins of victory. So, again, implications for how the United States is perceived in another country that's very important to our foreign policy.
All right. Well, speaking of trade policy, there were demonstrations this week in South Korea?
Yeah, in Seoul, something like 70,000 people, according to estimates, marched as the United States and South Korea negotiators were sitting down trying to negotiate a free trade deal that you've heard nothing about in this country. Also this week, and one of the other things that Bush and Putin were talking about in Putin's rapidly developing police state of Russia before the G8 conference, was that they weren't just talking about the Middle East. They were also talking about the World Trade Organization, which Russia is not yet a member of. In fact, it's the only industrialized country in the world that is not. Every other country in the WTO has agreed to Russia's admittance, but the United States has not. And why has the United States not agreed to Russia? Because the United States is essentially blackmailing Russia. They will not agree. They will not sign off on Russia's admission to it and get it past Congress, which has to approve it. The United States has enough votes in the WTO to veto the admission of Russia, unless Russia agrees to a certain quota of U.S. Farm products that it will bring in. In other words, what the United States is trying to do is underwrite its own industries, which is what the WTO is, supposedly dedicated to preventing, by exporting them to another country in order to allow it to be in the WTO. It's incredibly hypocritical, particularly when you consider that it was the U.S. that was pushing so hard for the rest of the international community to admit China a few years ago. And of course, the net result of that was the massive export of jobs from the United States, particularly manufacturing jobs, that have all now settled in China, where 70% or so of our manufactured goods are now made.
All right. Moving over to national, Valerie Plame Wilson.
has launched a lawsuit against Karl Rove and Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby and other, this wasn't really emphasized in the report, but, quote, other unnamed senior White House officials. And that last part could get really interesting. And, you know, it wasn't so much that that this is an extension of Patrick Fitzgerald's case, that the blowing of Valerie Plame Wilson's identity as a covert CIA operative was illegal, although it almost certainly was, but it destroyed her career, you know, for no other particular reason than political vengeance against her husband for something that her husband found that was turned out to be factual. So that lawsuit is going to extend this case a while longer. And we'll see where it goes, because the discovery attached to that could lead some places that Fitzgerald's probe did not, or has not so far.
All right. And early on in the week, it looks like the Pentagon has at least discovered part of the Geneva Conventions.
Yes, or the Bush administration has discovered part of it. Because of the Supreme Court ruling a couple weeks ago, which we talked about, the Pentagon has issued a memo saying that terrorists taken prisoner in the war on terror have to be treated under the Geneva Conventions. Now, that's all well and good for military facilities, but for CIA facilities and, you know, for the secret prison camps that we now know exist in Eastern Europe and other parts of the world, and for the case of prisoners that are taken by the CIA or other intelligence agencies, kidnapped and shipped off to third countries that practice torture, those practices have not yet been reined in by the Bush administration to comply with the Geneva Conventions and the Supreme Court decisions. So they haven't complied fully yet. And again, you know, all this is still talk, and what's been put down on paper, it won't necessarily be reflected in what happens in practice, but at least the policy is there. So it's a start.
All right, and a brief Abramoff update?
Yeah, that a couple of things. The House committee has subpoenaed Greenberg Taurig, which is the former lobby shop that Abramoff formerly worked for Abramoff's the record of Abramoff's and his employees' billings to anybody in the White House. So they are exploring Abramoff's specific lobbying ties to the White House. That could get interesting. Meantime, the Alabama Coushatta Indian tribe in Texas has sued Abramoff and Ralph Reed and Michael Scanlon, who is a convicted now former aide of Tom DeLay, and Neil Volz, who is a now convicted former aide of Congressman Bob Nye, and one of Abramoff's other lobbyist employees over, and I'll just read this as a direct quote, a fake religiously themed moral crusade in 2001 to defeat a bill in the Texas legislature that would have legalized gambling in Indian casinos. In other words, one gambling client of Abramoff's trying to prevent competition by another. And we saw these sorts of campaigns, and Ralph Reed was heavily involved in them all over the South in 2000, 2001, 2002. And now an Indian tribe is suing over it, and we'll probably see more of these.
All right. Well, the Voting Rights Act looked like it has been passed again.
Yeah, finally. It took a long time, and it was done over the objection of Republican Southern congressmen who are claiming that there isn't any discrimination in the South anymore, which, you know, I was in the South a few weeks ago, and I can promise you that there still is. And at the same time, another piece of good news besides the Voting Rights Act being passed is that the very restrictive voter ID law in Georgia that was in theory aimed at immigrants but in practice would have excluded anybody who couldn't produce, you know, birth certificate, that type of legal documentation in order to vote, that was thrown out as unconstitutional. So a small court victory there as well.
All right. And there are indications, if I'm correct in this, of a potential another spying scandal?
Yes. The chairman of the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee quoted, and I believe it was the Christian Science Monitor, as saying that he had heard from a whistleblower that there was another unreported, and he used the word significant, White House spying program that nobody's heard about. He sent along a strongly worded letter to President Bush. The White House briefed him on it. He now says that he, the Republican chairman, is satisfied about it. But we now know that the program exists. We don't know. He's not saying whether it's domestic or international and what the scope is, but we know that there's something else out there that hasn't been reported yet.
Okay. And Was it a report that came out this week that we could see why they would need these spying scandals for the new target list they came up with?
Yeah, this is an Inspector General report for the Department of Homeland Security, and there's a hilarious article in Wednesday's New York Times that runs down the tens of thousands of potential terrorist targets in the United States that is included in the DHS home database. And it's things like, you know, petting zoos and a mule ride and flea markets. It's all out of whack. The state with the most terrorist targets in the country is Indiana. Washington State has twice as many national monuments of significance as the District of Columbia. The state of Montana has more than New York. I mean, you know, it just goes on and on and on. Read the article. It's really frightening, and it shows a lot about, number one, the way the Bush administration has used fear and the idea that anybody could be attacked at any time to really terrorize the American public, and second, how out of control the bureaucracy around the war on terror has become.
All right. Only a few minutes left to cover local issues, starting out with Mark Wilson pulling out of the race.
Yeah, he's had a rough week. He announced last Saturday, a week ago, that he was withdrawing from the Senate race against Maria Cantwell. Then and at the press conference on Sunday with Senator Cantwell, he announced that not only was he withdrawing and throwing his support to her because he felt that her re-election was important in order to stop Mike McGavick from becoming a senator, which is true. But at the same time, it was revealed that he was going to work for Senator Cantwell's campaign. We found out later in the week that he's become her outreach director. He's getting paid $8,000 a month for it, which is what you pay for a statewide campaign, your very highest campaign officials. And so both he and Senator Cantwell have taken a lot of flack for that. Wilson has also taken a lot of flack because he's made various claims that, well, he hasn't really changed his stance on the war, even though criticism of Cantwell's support of the war in Iraq was really the backbone of his campaign. He had on his website a week ago that he called for the immediate pullout of troops from Iraq. And then at the press conference on Sunday, he was calling for the Bush frame of the troops will, the American troops will stand down when the Iraqi troops stand up, which is a very, very different approach. And then when we interviewed him on Como yesterday, I did an air shift there. He said that, he misspoke when he did that, which, you know, it's a pretty unambiguous statement, so I'm not sure what's going on with that. The other thing that came out is that the Cantwell campaign had also offered employment to Hung Tran, who is the other anti-war Democratic primary challenger, a Vietnamese attorney who's worked for, you know, various low-income projects, and that Wilson had also talked with her last week, telling her of his decision and urging her also to withdraw. She says she's not withdrawing. Of course, in November, Aaron Dixon, the Green Party candidate, and Bruce Griffiths, the Libertarian Party candidate, are also anti-war. So this issue is not going to go away for Maria Cantwell. And in a lot of ways, it's backfire because it's become a negative story for her.
All right. Very quickly, Greg Nichols has a plan for nightclubs.
Yeah. Check out the Strangers blog from, Thursday. Erica Barnett has a report on a draft ordinance for a nightclub licensing program being launched by the mayor's office that is beyond draconian. There's going to be a new lobbying group that's being formed of nightclub owners and their allies in the entertainment industry. And one of the organizers for them said this is 10 times worse than anything Mark Sidran ever came up with. And he's absolutely right. It's just really bad. Take a look at it. It really makes it virtually impossible to operate any kind of a bar or nightclub in the city of Seattle. It really comes down to that.
All right. Talking once again with John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is a volunteer publication that comes out every couple of weeks, covers local, national, international news. As I mentioned last week, and we didn't get to a number of things this week because there's so much going on in the Middle East especially, I'm going to start, and I won't do it while I'm on the road probably, but otherwise I will. I'm going to start taking the notes that I prepare for this program and putting them up on our blog, which is, you go to www.eatthestate.org and click on ETS blog on the right-hand side, and it'll take you right to it. We also put our issues up there on the website. We also have them in print at bookstores and cafes and other places where you find free publications. And right now, we need help with distribution. One of our biggest, in fact, by far our biggest distributor, had moved on because it's all volunteer distributors. So we need distributors in Capitol Hill, downtown, Fremont, Ballard, several places. We also are looking for a new co-editor because Tara Kent took a job that will require to work on weekends, which is when we edit the paper. So we'll have all that information in next issue. Take a look at it. If you're interested, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.